This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 158. Today we welcome Ron Gleason to the program to discuss his new biography of Herman Bavinck. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 158. My name is Camden Busey. We have a great panel and a great guest and topic for discussion today. And let me start by introducing to you Jim Cassidy, who is pastor of Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. Good afternoon, Jim.
Hey, Camden, how you doing?
I'm doing great, and it's great to have you on. We're very excited. We are also joined by our fantastic friend, Jeff Waddington, who is teacher of the congregation at Calvary OPC in Ringgoes. Hi, Jeff.
It's good to be here, Camden. So I was trying to think of something really brilliant or, you know, cute to say. The Order of Fantastic Friends, OFF.
OFF. We belong together.
Off.
Off. Yeah. Well, we'll get off this subject here and let me introduce our guest.
Segue.
Yeah. You see, it's not a good segue if you draw attention to it, Jim. But anyway.
Well, it really wasn't a good segue. So.
We've been going at this for a little while, and usually the later episodes of the day tend to get a little bit punchier and funnier. Mm-hmm. So that's the state we're in. But we are, honestly, truly very happy, excited, and honored to have on the program Ron Gleason today to discuss his new biography of Herman Bavinck, and we'll get to that in a moment. But I'd like to introduce Ron Gleason. He's pastor at Grace Presbyterian Church in Yorba Linda, California. Thanks for coming back on the program, Ron. It's great to have you.
It's great to be with the OFF again.
Yeah. The Order of the Fantastic Friends. And maybe another film in the works. If we have a Bavinck film, we can have an OFF film as well. Well, we have a great biography sitting in front of us. If you have been in a hole and have not heard about this, it's published by Presbyterian and Reformed Publishers. It is titled Herman Bavinck, Pastor, Churchman, Statesman, and Theologian. Just a fantastic book, not just simply a book of dates and events, but rather also an intellectual treatment as well, and the development of thought in the mind and in the work of Herman Bavinck, a gigantic figure in the Reformed world. And we're very pleased to be speaking about him today. So I would like to begin our discussion, but before we do that, I should mention that this biography is, we hear on the short list, a very short list, for the best Christian biography of 2010. So it is certainly no passing work, but as being considered by many people to be a very influential piece. So we would welcome and encourage you to go out and pick up a copy. Now, I was just speaking with a pastor, a new pastor of my parents, about Herman Bavinck, and he had mentioned, he had asked me if I would start reading Herman Bavinck with him, perhaps, and he'd said, it's this guy, and his works were just translated back in 2003. Have you heard of him? And I said, oh, Herman Bavinck, of course. And we have to read him in seminary now. And it just reminded me, because when we're at Westminster and other similar places in the present day, we take Bavinck as a given, that people know him, that people understand him, that they're familiar with his work because it's so important. But this has not always been the case. And I wanted to ask you, Dr. Gleason, just to begin, how you became interested in Herman Bavinck, and how have you seen this man over the last few years as he has become much more known to an English audience?
Well, that's a great question. I started out learning about Bavinck in around 1974. I was a Byington teaching fellow with Roger Nicole, to whom I have dedicated the book. Mm-hmm. And it was really just kind of a sidebar. Roger recently died. He died a day after his 95th birthday. Mm. And he received the book 3 days before he died.
Wow.
And I talked with Daniel Wright, who was a man who was taking care of Roger. And he said Roger was just absolutely delighted that this happened. Well, I shared an office with Roger Nicole, and We were talking one day, and he was encouraging me to go to the Netherlands to study, and he said, I think you ought to read Bobbink. And I said, who's he? And he's this great theologian. And so what happened that year was once I got introduced to him, Nicole said that he thought I should take an overload course and add to my overload theological Dutch. And I said, well, who's going to teach it?
Yeah.
He said, well, I will. And I said, anybody else going to be in the class? And he said, nope. So they had to prepare pretty well, because the chances of getting called on were pretty decent.
Got to pay attention.
I started with a book, and he gave me, we photocopied some pages of the Reformed Dogmatics. And I did find a Dutch dictionary in the library. And I got some of the cards that we used to keep our Greek and our Hebrew on, and I started with the inductive method, looked up the word. So I put in the introductory comments to the book that the first few days probably took me well over an hour to read one page, and that was on a good day. And I began to learn the language more and more, and the more I learned about it, the more I became intrigued, not only about the words that were on the page, but the meaning of the words and what this man was saying. And I came to understand that Bobbink was on par with people like John Calvin and Heinrich Bullinger and the great reformers. This guy had digested all of them, and had then distilled them down into his own particular way of thinking. And the interesting aspect I found of Bobbink's teaching when he was in Compton, but not so much at the Free University after he left Compton, but in Compton, was that he was the professor of both dogmatics as well as ethics. And I just found out that a couple of years ago that an historian in the Netherlands just found all of his ethics notes, and we're in the process of getting together the Reformed Ethics of Herman Bobbink.
Wow.
Which will be a very exciting project, to say the least. But the more I began to read him, I just became enthralled with his style. He was thoroughly Reformed at every point, but he was probably one of the most Irenic theologians I had read in a while. And so once this got going, I wrote some letters to the Free University, and Nicole wrote some for me, and the next thing I knew, in 1975, my wife and our then two children were on the way to Amsterdam to begin to study theology, and that's how I, and it, once I got there, even though the theology in the Netherlands when I arrived in 1975 was pretty liberal and mostly German, I just held on to this love I had for this man, and it didn't take me long once we got there and we learned the language to get through the entire dogmatics and then to begin to read his other works as well.
That's fantastic.
Wow. Dr. Gleason, just a question about his pastorate. He had a very short pastorate, 1 year. You have this wonderful chapter here on his pastorate. And one of the things that struck me, I think, was how in the mind of Bobbink, there was no dichotomy between pastoral ministry and a robust intellectually energetic theology that is deep, that is engaging. And I'm just wondering if maybe you could give us some comments, especially to our listening audience, many of whom are pastors. Could you address how Bobbink might teach us today some lessons, especially relative to this dichotomizing that is out there today between doing practical pastoral ministry and then doing theology?
Yeah, great question. And Bobbink was aided in that, and the initial, the outset of the book, I talk about his father. Jan Bobbink had a profound influence on Herman's life. And Jan Bobbink was just this type of pastor himself. He was very, very scholarly. He was quite able in all of the languages. He was a near expert in Latin. and maintained yet a very, very warm and compassionate ministry. And I think Herman Bovink learned a lot from his father as far as that goes. Even though this is not a direct quote from Bovink, I believe that this really summarizes what Bovink believes. Scholarship's best place is in the pulpit. He was a consummate preacher, and it's really ironic that many of his sermons are only in handwritten form in the various archives in Holland, in Compton, and in the Free University. There is one sermon that has been published, but Bovink, whenever Bovink would preach at this one church, for example, in Franeker, they were in the process, when he left, of having to take out the entire back wall to make more space, because this was one of those instances where truly it was standing room only. Now, there were some skeptics when he went there because he attended Leiden. Leiden had begun as a very reformed seminary, but that was also became the teaching home of Jacob Arminius after a while, and then his follower Episcopius, and then from there the University of Groningen was begun, just to have, once again, a strongly Calvinistic seminary and university in the country. But Bovink had, while he was there, he had, as you mentioned, robust is just a great word to describe it, because he had a very robust ministry, but he was also keeping up with all of the theological trends. He believed that in order for a pastor to be able to apply the scriptures practically, that he had to be a spiritual man. And I believe that the words spiritual and practical were synonymous for Bovink. And so that would account for the fact that he kept up his teaching abilities, but at the same time, he was very, very adept at getting into the pulpit and preaching the Word of God. I think what's happened in our day and age, and I remember this from, let me give a couple examples. Sure. One was in when I was in seminary back in the dark ages, from 73 to 75. When I left, somebody said to me, well, I guess you're going to come back and be a teacher at the school. And I said, I don't know. I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. But I was in the presence of R.C. Sproul one time, and some students said to me, why, with all of the studying that you've done, why are you just a pastor? And I was getting ready to respond, but I didn't have to, because Sproul responded for me. And he kind of laid into the guy and said, don't ever say just a pastor.
Yeah.
The unspoken idea was, when I was in seminary, I think it's just a horrible idea. If you're an average student, you're going to be a pastor. If you're mm-hmm. really a bright guy, you're going to be a professor.
Right.
And I've been a pastor in three foreign countries, in Holland and in Canada and now in Southern California, which is the strangest of all the countries I've ever been to. But I believe
never in America. Then
you're not on you're not on Azusa Street, are you?
No. But I think it's really important for us to realize that. Well, just stop and think about the Reformation. The great preachers were all scholars.
Yep.
I mean, almost to a man. And yet what we have had, I think, in our time is that there has been this bifurcation between the practicality of getting down. And practicality, as I've come to understand it, in the modern setting, in the modern ecclesiastical setting, means somebody's reading all of the self-help books on the market and reading all the Barna stuff and then putting that into the pulpit and giving Christians kind of a 3, 5, 7, 12-step program to help them get through their difficulties rather than really feeding them in depth on the Word of God.
Mm-hmm. Amen. wanted to ask you a little bit about, because this is, for me, as I was reading the biography here, an interesting, very fascinating dynamic in Bovink's life. He goes to Campen, of course, and when he's there, he receives several calls to come and to teach at the Free University in Amsterdam. Would you be able to give our listeners perhaps a sketch as to the dynamics of what was happening there and why he receives these several calls and then turns them down and stays at Campen for nearly 20 years?
Yeah, that was just a fascinating part of writing the biography, and it really is indicative a little bit about Bobbink's personality. As resolute as he was in his theology, he took over from his father, I believe, a kind of a waffling mentality when it came to decisions like that. His mother was decidedly more resolute, and I put in the biography there was a section about when Bobbink's dad was appointed to the same position that his son held at the same age. They were both 28 when they were appointed, and young Jan Bobbink didn't make up his mind. And what he did was he wrote two letters. In one letter, he accepted the position. And in the other letter, he declined. And he put them in an envelope, sealed the envelopes, and called one of the students from the school to come into his study and pick up one of the letters and put it in the mailbox. But he was trusting in the lot and God's providence on this, and the student picked up the rejection and put it in the mailbox. And there was a lot that... Herman's mother said to Jan about that. I can't repeat that on the air. She was not pleased, to say the least. And then there was I have the first part of the book is dedicated to Jan Bobbink. I have probably the only copy of Jan Bobbink's autobiography. I'm just trying to figure out who wrote it. And that was a joke. But anyway, these guys are slow. The OFF,
oh,
they're really slow today.
Autobiography.
Yeah. Anyway, so he talked about how he, once that happened and his wife responded to him the way that she did and said, well, you should have taken this position, how he decided that he really had made the wrong decision. And in Bobbink's diary, I came across an entry where he mentioned the fact that his father was the same age when he was called, but it was Bobbink's determination that he would accept this position because that's what he wanted to do. So I think that there's a lot to be said for the way that Bobbink's father aided him immensely, not only in his academic pursuits, but also in developing a pastor's heart. Now, there was also a section in the biography where I talked about what a big deal it was that Bobbink ended up going to Leiden. Everybody expected him to go to the theological seminary in Kampen. And all of a sudden, he announces he's going to the hotbed of liberalism. And Bobbink's father, as well as Bobbink, got a lot of heat for that. There was a lot of pressure for him to change his views. And then even after he finished his studies there and had his doctorate and graduated with the highest honors you could possibly graduate, they made him go through kind of an entry-level exam just to make sure he was still kosher.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was just kind of a dig that came in at the very end. But, you know, he survived. But that's an interesting twist in his life.
There was actually a time, wasn't there, Ron, when he was assigned a text to preach from, and he actually declined, or he refused to preach that text.
Refused to preach it.
Right?
Yeah, it was the Matthew text. They're all blind guides. Leave them. And I make mention of that in the biography that he refused to preach on the text. And then when he finally did concede, I mean, he preached this very good sermon. But he stared at the man who gave him the text through the whole sermon. So for all the pastors out there who are having rough spots in their pastorates, as we all do, that I think it's very, very important to remember that, you know, bombing started out top two. But, I mean, historically, it's understandable, because what happened was bombing's father came out of the old state church that in 1834 there was a movement out of the state church, which was illegal. And it was just a horrible time following the Batavian Republic in the Netherlands. The state church had just gone from bad to worse. And at the time of 1834, the state church had, and the state universities that were teaching these pastors, were allowing Buddhists and atheists to study theology. Mm. And they were then being assigned to various pulpits throughout the country. And so there was this reaction to all of that, and the churches that moved out of the state church and were finally recognized after 1834 went back to the three forms of unity and the church order of Dort, and to a view of the infallibility of the scriptures, which is a good thing. And there was something similar going on with Kuyper in the movement that I described, that's come down to us as the Doleantse. And really, it's a tough word to translate from Dutch. It basically means the complainers. But they were not complaining about anything other than the sad state of affairs ecclesiastically in the Netherlands. So we had these two groups kind of going, and once bombing then made the decision to go to Leiden, I mean, it was just incomprehensible. It was unconscionable for most of the people, and historically it's understandable.
Another key chapter that you include in this biography deals with the signpost debacle. What was that debacle in brief, and what lessons might we learn from it?
Well, a lot of the whole idea of signpost, it's a bit of a problem that really is taking place within the Netherlands, and it has to do with the whole idea of politics and how politics gets involved in our lives. Now, I think for the Dutch, there was a movement known as the Anti-Revolutionary Party, and that's part of the discussion in that particular chapter. But it had to do with a whole theological and political movement that involved a man named Lohmann and Kuyper. Those were the two primary players. Lohmann was a very, very able politician, and he was one of the. Once a man named Groen van Prinsteren died, Kuyper took over the reins of the Anti-Revolutionary Party. Kuyper was a great statesman in many regards. He had his foibles like anyone else, and at times he was not the easiest, maybe not even the second easiest person in the world to get along with. And he actually at times ran roughshod over those who were on his side. And Lohmann was one of these men who chose at key points and key times to stand up to Kuyper. And Kuyper did not appreciate that. He just did not like challenges. And so as this thing began to develop and to as they began to talk about this more and more, it had a lot to do with the whole idea of the school and how the schools were to be run and a whole bunch of other political things. But what happened was, and long story short, there was this public humiliation of Lohmann at this place called the Signpost, which is a meeting place near The Hague and a little place near called Scheveningen. And Bobbing just lamented the fact that it happened this way. Although, you know, as I pointed out in that particular chapter, Bobbing was a man of his time, and he certainly was not infallible. And he kind of got caught up in the whole thing as well. And he was, and to some degree, he was complicit. Although what happened with the Lohmann case was the law of unintended consequences in spades. And Bobbick never thought it would go that far. It would never be the kind of public humiliation that it turned out to be. And basically, it ended up being a condemnation without a real investigation and a real hearing, which Bobbick came to understand later in his life that certainly was a complete violation of what he was taught in the Heidelberg Catechism, where it says that we will condemn no one rashly and unheard. So there were a number of people involved. As I say, Kuyper was the main player in that. But I think for people who are not up with what's going on in politics and how politics work, that would be a very instructive chapter as you go through that. I think it starts on about page 206 or something. Mm. I think it's more instructive on how do we treat people with whom we disagree.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I mean, obviously, if you're dealing with someone who is heretical in nature, then you're probably going to deal with them in a very definitive manner. You're not going to broker any or allow any type of well, this is nice and this is nice. So you're going to deal with that quite differently. But the hard thing about this was that Kuyper and Lohmann and Bobbick and Hovey and many of the others that were involved in this were all probably in 99% agreement. And so it's that one particular thing that we can jump on. And it's very practical. My wife will say to me, my wife and I, of course, I'm a pastor, so we don't have arguments. We just have intense fellowship. And we were having some intense fellowship one time, and she asked me a question that I really wasn't prepared to answer. She said to me, "How much do you love me?" I said, "What do you mean, how much do I love you?" She said, "Percentage-wise." I said, "Percentage-wise?" And she said, "Yeah, percentage-wise, how much do you love me?" So I thought, boy, my answer better be good here. So I said, probably 98%. Is that good?
Is it?
She said, "Yeah, that's fine." She said, "So why do you always pick on the 2%
you love?"
So I got nailed.
You did.
But
you
did, didn't you?
It's true, and that's sometimes I see that in our own circles.
Is that illustrative of the little quote you have in the acknowledgments with to your daughters-in-law? You say, "I still love most of you."
Yeah.
I wondered what that
family,
meant.
That's the kind of a family joke that we have. I still love most of you. Yeah,
somewhat related.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, did you have something about Bobbick's theology here?
Yeah, just Ron, a couple of questions about his theology. And I guess it's kind of a twofold question. First of all, in terms of, you know, Bobbick is, as you opened up our discussion here, described as a thoroughly reformed theologian. And I guess if you could give us paint perhaps a brief sketch of Bobbick's theology, is he advancing at all reformed theology in his writings, or is he merely conserving it? And if he's advancing it at all, what are some of the key theological insights that he gives us in his writings that we can that we really need to grasp today?
Okay, great question. I think the short answer is he is both conserving and he is advancing. In the intro to the first edition of the first volume that came out in 1895, he said, This theology that I'm writing is going to be reflective primarily of the time of the Reformation, and most specifically in the writings of John Calvin. Now, it didn't mean that he was only writing from the standpoint of just trying to replicate what Calvin had done. He says that it's imperative for us to stand on the shoulders of those who have gone before us. And so you would find one of the great things about reading the Reformed dogmatics is that he has these masterful sections dealing with the history of dogma. And he will take you through, and he'll walk you through the Church Fathers, he'll walk you through the Middle Ages, he'll walk you through those guys and then to the Reformation, and he will tell you what he thinks about that. But certainly he was very, very dependent upon those that had gone before him. So in that sense, he was one who conserved what had been written before. But at the same time, he also believed that he had a task as a theologian, which was to take what he had learned from them and move it forward. One of the things that I think, or let me give you two things I think were really important, and one of them I wrote about in my doctoral dissertation on Bobbing, and that is he took the notion of the mystical union of the believer with Christ, and I think he reworked that and rewove it into the fabric of his theology in such a way that the Christian and the Christian pastor and the Christian theologian cannot walk away from the Reformed dogmatics without learning how central the concept of the mystical union of the believer with Christ is. That is something that he hammers on quite a bit. The other concept that I think he began to work out in a way that's been very, very helpful to me, and I think it would be helpful to others, is the need to have a consistent biblical life and worldview. I mean, we talk a lot about Christian worldview, but Bobbink, in his Reformed Dogmatics as well as in his speeches and occasional writings, spent a great deal of time working out the whole idea of the worldview. And he did that, I think, hand in hand with his ethics. I think the fact that he taught ethics as well was something that helped him a great deal. And he had sections, especially as the last page, actually, in Volume 1 of the translation of the Reformed Dogmatic, he has a summary of the whole idea of the relationship of dogmatics and ethics just before he gets into his theological method. So those two things, I think, the Unio Mystica and a consistent biblical life and worldview, and both of those are very, very necessary, and they fit together like a hand in a glove, because if I don't have a consistent relationship between that which I know from Scripture and that which I put into practice in terms of my ethical behavior on a daily basis, my whole life and worldview is going to reflect that. I think a lot of what we have in modern evangelicalism today is a very, very fragmented and very disjunctive life and worldview, if the people are taught to have one at all. I think we're living in almost an unprecedented time of biblical ignorance. It's amazing to me that we have so many translations, and you know, we have the college student's devotional Bible, and we have the divorced woman's devotional Bible, and we have the Hungarian soccer kicker's devotional Bible. But we have all of these things, but at the same time, with these masses of Bibles that are available, the Christian population in general today is just abysmally ignorant of even the fundamental truths of Holy Scripture.
Yeah.
Ron, I thoroughly enjoyed the biography, being the only one here apparently who has actually finished it.
Finished it. We're getting there. It's already not yet.
Does Bovink get a hearing in the Netherlands now, or is he a forgotten figure?
He's fading rapidly. When I was I lived in the Netherlands from 1975 to 1985, and you could buy Bobbing very, very, very inexpensively when I was there. They would pay you to take Kuiper out of the bookstore. What was happening at that time, I mean, obviously Karl Barth was a major figure, and I remember the last doctoral seminar I took at the Free University of Amsterdam was Karl Barth and Socialism. And many of the students, I think half the class at the time consisted of card-carrying communists, and they just thought that Karl Barth's socialism didn't go nearly far enough. He should have just been a full-on communist. So there were a lot of, he's still appreciated in certain circles, and everybody knows he's a good name. Everybody knows that he, as far as the country is concerned, He was well known. He was received like Kuiper was only a few years later at Princeton for the Stone Lectures. And but there are very, very few people that really appreciate him. I'm working on another book on Bobbink right now, and I was just working yesterday on it. And he was talking about this one particular group of theologians that he constantly interacted with. It was a group called the Ethical Theologians, and one of them was many of them were very dependent upon Schleiermacher for a lot of their theology. And Bobbink was talking then about Albrecht Ritschl, and he was saying at this time, so where we're talking about the early 1880s, he said the Ritschl isn't even read or understood anymore. So I mean, so I think what happens in theology is kind of parallel with what happens in the world. We are, unfortunately, we get very tired very quickly of the old, and we're always looking for the new, and we're looking for the unique event. And that's why I think we have so many fads and trends in Christianity these days. I mean, when is the last time that you heard anything in depth recently about the emergent church?
Mm.
You don't. I mean, it was a big deal,
and
it was a really big deal. And McLaren's probably still running around doing his shtick, but it's one of those things where it was gangbusters, and everybody was jumping on that bandwagon, and just kind of faded in the background. And I think what's happened in the Netherlands as well is people have moved away from people like Bobbink, and maybe somebody will come along that would be as good. I kind of doubt it, because this guy was one in a million. He really was. I put him, as I said, I put him up on the plane with Calvin and Bullinger easily. And I guess Bullinger is kind of the forgotten reformer as well. But
yeah, right.
I think Bullinger's up there with Calvin for sure. But we tend to if you can mention names, whether it's Turretin or whether it's Owen, I don't care who it is, Bobbink's up there with them.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say Bobbink is usually paired with Kuiper and Warfield as the Reformed triumvirate of the late 19th, early 20th century.
Really interesting. All three of those guys died within 8 months of each other.
Huh.
Yeah. Same year.
And you do, by the way, you do a very moving portrayal of the last days of Bobbink's life.
Well, yeah, it was really kind of interesting because I got to meet Bobbink's only child when I lived when I was a pastor in The Hague, and a man named Rolf Brimmer, and I was very dependent upon Brimmer in the book, was also a minister in the same denomination where I was a minister. And he said to me one day, we were talking on the phone, he said, "Well, you know," he said, "have you met Bobbink's daughter?" I said, "No, she's dead, isn't she?" And he said, "No, she lives in The Hague." And so I called her up and talked to her and told her who I was and what I was doing. And she received me into her home in The Hague. And we had the requisite coffee and cookies that they have in Holland all the time. And she talked about her dad. And it was just amazing to me how much she loved her father. And it wasn't because he was popular, but it was because he was a really good dad and a very good grandfather. Mm-hmm. And so it really put a lot of flesh on Bobbink for me, and especially when it came to the time of his death. And I talked in the biography about some of the people who want to say, I mean, it's kind of a going thing. Everybody wants to say that Bobbink has changed. And I don't care whether it's Pete Enns or Andrew McGowan, or they want to say, well, you know, he had this view of Scripture, and it was more modern than it was traditional. And that simply isn't true.
Hmm.
It simply isn't true. I mean, he wrestled with questions. He didn't do end runs around questions and try to dodge them. He met them head on. But I think he's, for anybody who wants to go out and purchase the Reformed dogmatics, that would be something I believe that you would keep for a lifetime and that you would go back to over and over and over again. It's just that good.
I agree. I think we all do. We always encourage people to look at Bobbink. We're so thankful that his works are now, many of them, most of them, translated. And we are also very thankful for this biography. For the sake of time, I have to wrap things up. I'm a little disappointed, but we're very appreciative for the work that you've done, Dr. Gleason. We want to thank you very much for taking the time today to join us on Crisis Center.
It was my honor to be here, and I can tell you, I feel a little bit guilty because I had too much fun writing it.
Well, that's always a good thing, I suppose. If you do what you love for work, then you never really work.
You never really work, do you?
Yeah. So thank you so much. And I do want to mention a few things that you can visit online. You can visit Grace Presbyterian Church of Yorba Linda, California at gracepresbyterian.net. As well as Dr. Gleason's blog is available at Ron Gleason, that's RONGLEASON.blogspot.com, RonGleason.blogspot.com. We will have links to all of these things in the show notes as well. And again, the biography, Herman Bavinck, pastor, churchman, statesman, and theologian from PNR, an excellent volume. You can visit WTSbooks.com for a great price on it today. Of course, we are available online as well at reformedforum.org. And there you'll find information about all of our programs, as well as how you can subscribe to them, get them downloaded automatically to your computer. And please, if you're able, visit us at reformforum.org/donate and help us to continue to produce and distribute all of these programs free of charge. We want to thank everybody for listening, and we look forward to having you back next time on Christ the Center.